It's great to be here with you today. I'd like to start with a few questions, and you don't need to raise your hand. Just speak out if you know the answer. Speak out loudly enough that everybody could hear.
If someone has a question, I have the mic. They can raise their hand. I'll get them.
Okay. If you have something with a bunch of words in it, then Chris will bring you the mic. But if you're just going to answer what I'm asking you, it can be done probably in one syllable or maybe two.
Okay.
So we'll see how it goes. Anyway, if you need Chris to take the microphone to everybody that speaks, just speak up. But I just have some simple questions. Number one, how many lists of the apostles are there in the New Testament? How many lists of the apostles are there in the New Testament? I hear two. I hear maybe three. Is that your final answer? Who are you going to call? How many lists of the apostles are there in the New Testament? If you had given the right answer, I would be going on to the next question. I hear four, and that's right. Four lists. What? They are all complete, if by complete we mean the ones that were alive at the time. Which leads me into the next question. What books are those found? You don't have to give me the chapter, but what books are those lists found in? Matthew? Mark? Luke? Acts. Right. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and Acts. Matthew 10, Mark 3, Luke 6, and Acts 1, when Judas was already dead, so his name wouldn't be in that final list. But Matthias was selected just right after that list was given. All right. Whose name is first in all four of those lists? Peter is first in all four of those lists. Who is the only person in the gospel records mentioned more than Peter? Who is the only person in the gospel records mentioned more than Peter? Jesus. Jesus is the only person mentioned more than Peter in the gospels. Which apostle did the Lord speak to more than any other apostle according to the records we have? Which apostle did Jesus speak to more than any other apostle? Not Paul, not John. Peter, yes. Very good. What apostle was most pointedly and directly reproved by the Lord? Peter, yes. What apostle ventured to reprove the Lord? Peter again. What apostle most boldly confessed the Lord and most outspokenly acknowledged and encouraged the Lord? Peter again. What apostle tempted the Lord? Peter again. Yes. So you're getting the idea, I think, that we're going to talk about Peter. That's what I hope to do this morning. He's such an interesting man. We have so much information comparatively about him. The Lord spoke words of approval and blessing to Peter, the like of which he never spoke to any other person, not only any other apostle, but any other person. And at the same time, and in almost the same breath, the Lord said harsher things to Peter than he ever said to any of the 12, except for Judas, of course. He had something pretty harsh to say to Judas one time. So we all know enough about Peter to see his humanness come through, and I'd like to emphasize his humanness today. Peter was eager, he was aggressive, he was bold, he was outspoken. Somebody called Peter the apostle with the foot-shaped mouth. The apostle with the foot-shaped mouth. And I kind of like that. In the first 12 chapters of the book of Acts, again, the main character is Peter. He's the driving force there. In Matthew 10, Jesus particularly and specifically chose Peter. We're told that out of all the people that he could have chosen, one of the ones he chose was Peter. He did it on purpose. And there's nothing in Peter that's perfect. There's nothing that's all complete. He's not but a big beginning from his head to the soles of his feet. That's the way I think of Peter when he was first chosen. He's just a big beginning. But he stands out as the spokesman of the 12. And you're aware of this. He asked the meaning of a difficult saying in the 15th chapter of Matthew. He asked how often he must forgive in the 18th chapter of Matthew. He asked what was to be the reward of those who had left all and followed Christ like himself in the 19th chapter of Matthew. He asked about the fig tree and why it had withered in the 11th chapter of Mark. He asked about the approaching end of things in Mark chapter 13. He was looked at as being the leader among the apostles. Whether that was always true or not, that was the way he was viewed. It was to Peter that the Jews came to ask if Jesus paid his taxes in Matthew 17. It was Peter who answered when Jesus asked who had touched him in the crowd in Luke chapter 8. It was Peter who questioned the risen Christ in John chapter 21. Peter was always verbalizing, always initiating dialogue because he wanted to know. And Peter was a man who made things happen. This is the man whom the Lord chose, but when he was chosen, he wasn't called Peter. What was he called when he was chosen?
Simon
was his name. He was the son of a man named Jonas, which is also the name for John. He was a fisherman by profession. He had a brother named Andrew. They lived first in Bethsaida, and then they lived in Capernaum. Peter was married, and he had a mother-in-law. And Paul said in 1 Corinthians 9 that he had a right to lead about a wife like Peter did. So he not only had a wife, but he led her about. In other words, she was with him. She may have been with him a substantial portion of the time. Simon was a very common name. There are at least 7 Simons in the gospel accounts. Beside the Simon that we're talking about today, can you think of some other Simons? Just spout it out. Simon the sorcerer. Simon the zealot. That's 2. Any other Simons you can think of? That's interesting. Simon's a very common name. Remember one time Jesus went to a house and the guy that was giving the feast was named Simon. Jesus referred to him as Simon. In fact, that actually happened twice, and it seems to be 2 different Simons. One is Simon the leper and the other is just referred to as Simon. So that's a couple more Simons. Did you mention Simon of Cyrene? He was the one that carried the cross of Jesus part of the way to Calvary. Also, Judas Iscariot had a father. What was his father's name? It was Simon. Good guess. So there are a bunch of Simons, a bunch of them in the Gospels, and then Simon the sorcerer was not in the Gospels, but is in the book of Acts. Jesus had a bunch of half-brothers, one of whose name was Simon also. So there are at least 7 Simons in the Gospels and then at least 1 in the book of Acts. So the guy that we're talking about today, his full name at birth was Simon Bar-Jonah, meaning Simon, son of Jonah. This is in Matthew 16, verse 17. Blessed art thou, Simon Bar-Jonah. It just means Simon, son of Jonah, John 21, verses 15 through 17. His father's name was John, which is sometimes rendered as Jonah or Jonas. Other than that, we don't know anything else about Peter's parents. But the Lord gave Simon another name. It's Simon whom he also called Peter, Luke 6:14. Simon whom he also named Peter. Peter is the Greek name. Cephas is the Aramaic name, but they are the same. What does Peter or Cephas mean in English? Rock. Yes, rock or stone. So the Lord did not give him a new name to replace the old one. He also named him Peter. He gave him this nickname, as it were, to go along with his other name. Sometimes he was known as Simon, sometimes he's known as Peter, sometimes he's known as Simon Peter. We'll talk more about that in a moment. But this is a nickname. Petros is the Greek word for rock. By nature, Simon was brash. He was vacillating. He could go one way and then the other moment he'd go the other way. He could be kind of undependable. Maybe he was a double-minded man who was unstable in all his ways, as we're told about in James 1, verse 8. I believe that Jesus gave Peter this nickname, Rock, as a perpetual reminder of what Peter should be. Every time Peter called him Rock, then he's thinking, yeah, I should be a rock. That would be the best way to do. Sometimes a nickname can help a person. Tommy Lasorda was the manager of the Los Angeles Dodgers years ago. They purchased a skinny young pitcher in their minor league system. This kid had an extraordinary arm and a very accurate and powerful arm, but he was extremely timid in his personality. Tommy Lasorda was convinced that this young pitcher had the potential to be one of the best, but he could see that he needed to be fiercer. He needed to be more competitive. He needed to lose the timidity. And so Tommy Lasorda gave him a nickname that was exactly the opposite of his personality. He called him Bulldog. And if you follow baseball, you may know that over the years, that's exactly what Oral Hershiser became. Oral Hershiser is one of the great pitchers of the past, one of the most tenacious competitors, now that we look back on his career, who ever took the major league mound. But this nickname, Bulldog, became a perpetual reminder of what he ought to be, what his manager wanted him to be. And eventually it shaped his whole attitude. So this man, Simon, and I wish we knew his age. Wouldn't it be great if we had a full biography of the Apostle Peter? I mean, like 700 pages that tells you everything about his life, and everything he did, everything that happened to him. That would just be so great. Evidently, we don't need it because we don't have it. But if we had that, it would just amplify the themes we already have. He was impetuous. He was impulsive. He was overeager sometimes. But he needed to become a rock. And that's why I believe he was given this nickname. It seems that we have a couple of different contexts in the New Testament in which he was called Simon. One is his secular identity. When the scripture refers to his house, for example, it's usually Simon's house. Mark 1:29, Luke 4:38. Cornelius, in the 10th chapter of Acts, is given directions to Simon's house, the place he was staying, the house of Simon the Tanner, who is yet another Simon in the book of Acts. Peter's mother-in-law is called Simon's wife's mother, Mark 1:30 and again Luke 4:38. Luke 5:3 talks about Simon's boat, his fishing boat. And Luke 5:10 says that James and John were partners with Simon. So his work, his home, his family life, these are Simon's things. The second context in which he's called Simon is when he's acting or thinking like his old self. His old pre-Jesus self. When he's thinking, talking, or acting like his old self, he gets called by his old name. Let me give you an example of that. In Luke chapter 5, verse 5, the Lord said, Simon, put out into the deep water and let down your nets for a catch. And Simon says, Master, we've worked all night, we've caught nothing. Nevertheless, at your word, I'll let down the nets, but the insinuation is that he didn't think it was going to do any good. Well, that's Simon, the fisherman, speaking. He's been a fisherman all his life, and he knows what works and what doesn't. We fished all night. We didn't catch anything. This isn't going to work either. He's skeptical. He's reluctant. But as he obeys, and they catch enough fish to fill not just one boat, but two boats, then his eyes are open to who Jesus really is, and Luke begins to use the new name. In verse 8, when Simon Peter saw it, he fell down at Jesus' knees saying, Depart from me, O Lord, for I am a sinful man. Again, in Luke 22, verse 31, Simon, Simon. Doesn't just say Simon once, he says it twice. Simon, Simon, indeed Satan has demanded permission to sift you like wheat. So it's not just Simon, it's Simon, Simon. I remember when I was a boy, sometimes my dad would just look at me and shake his head and say, son, son. So disappointed. And that's the way the Lord's looking at Simon, saying, Simon, Simon. Later in the Garden of Gethsemane, when Peter should have been watching and praying with Jesus, he fell asleep. And when Jesus came and found him sleeping, he said to Peter, Simon, are you sleeping? Couldn't you even watch with me 1 hour? Watch and pray, lest you enter into temptation, because the spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. That's Mark chapter 14, verses 37 and 38. So usually, when Peter needed some admonition or rebuke, Jesus referred to him as Simon. And it must have reached a point at which, whenever the Lord said Simon, Peter just kind of cringed. Oh, come on, call me Rock. And I think the insinuation was that I'll call you Rock when you act like a rock. I think that's the message the Lord was trying to put across. The Apostle John knew Peter very, very well. They were not only close friends and they lived close together, but they were also business associates as well as being neighbors. In the Gospel of John, John refers to his friend 15 times as Simon Peter. And I've wondered if that's just because maybe John couldn't completely decide which name to use because he saw both sides of Peter. He knew both sides of Peter very well. He knew them constantly, so he just puts both names together. In fact, Simon Peter is what Peter calls himself in the introduction to his second epistle. Simon Peter, a bondservant and apostle of Jesus Christ. That's 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 1. So in effect, he took Jesus' nickname for him and he made it his surname, like we have in Acts 10, verse 32, Simon Peter. After the resurrection, Jesus instructed his disciples to return to Galilee and that he would appear to them there. This is in Matthew 28, verse 7. Simon apparently got tired of waiting, and so he announced that he was going back to fishing. That's John 21, verse 3. And Simon was the leader. He was viewed as the leader, even by the other apostles, so their others followed him. They got into a boat. They fished all night. They caught nothing. Jesus met them on the shore the following morning where he had prepared breakfast for them. And the purpose of this breakfast meeting seems to have been the restoration of Peter, because Peter had sinned and sinned egregiously by denying Christ with curses on the night that the Lord was betrayed. Three times he had denied Christ, and now three times Jesus addressed him as Simon. Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me? Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me? And this was the last time that Jesus ever had to call him Simon. A few weeks later, on the day of Pentecost, Peter and the rest of the apostles were filled with the Holy Spirit, and it was Peter the Rock who stood up and preached that day. I'm talking about Peter because he was exactly like most of us. He was both carnal and spiritual. He had elements of both. He succumbed to the flesh sometimes, and he functioned in the spirit at other times. He was sinful sometimes, but other times he behaved in the way a righteous man ought to. One time I had the responsibility for a congregation, and I was trying to lead them in a look for a permanent leadership. So I arranged a dinner where all the families of the congregation would be in each other's homes in small groups for a discussion one Sunday afternoon on this subject of permanent leadership for the congregation. And the first discussion question I gave them to talk about was that age-old debate prompter, are leaders born or made? Are leaders born or made? Well, I think Peter is a strong argument for the belief that leaders are born with certain innate gifts, but leaders must also be shaped to be true, good leaders. Peter had the God-given fabric of leadership woven into his personality from the beginning. God put it there. He was made out of the right raw material, but he had to be tempered. Peter was, from the beginning, he was not happy to remain an ignorant man about things he didn't understand. He was insatiably curious. He was hungry to find out the answers to things. In the gospel accounts, Peter actually asked more questions than all of the other apostles combined. Peter asked more questions than all of the other apostles combined. He always wanted to understand better. He wasn't the smartest guy you ever met, but he wanted to understand. He had the drive. He had the ambition. He had the energy to take the initiative. He not only asked questions, but he was also the first one usually to answer questions when the Lord asked them. Who do you say that I am? Well, while the other apostles were still processing that question, Peter just jumps right in. You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Doesn't bat an eye about it. The others are still thinking about it, but Peter was bold. Peter was decisive. In the Garden of Gethsemane, now think about this. In the Garden of Gethsemane, when the Roman soldiers came from Fort Antonia to arrest Jesus, there was a great multitude of soldiers and others that were armed with swords and staves. A typical Roman cohort was 600 soldiers. So in all likelihood, there were hundreds of battle-ready Roman troops in and around the Garden of Gethsemane that night. But without hesitating, Peter pulls out his sword and takes a swing at the head of Malchus, servant of the high priest. The high priest was the one who was ordering the arrest, and his entourage would have been at the front of the group. Malchus didn't let his head get chopped off. He ducked, but he did get his ear chopped off. Jesus touched his ear and healed him and said, "Peter, put up your sword." Think about that incident. There are hundreds of Roman soldiers there. What does Peter think he's going to do? Is he going to behead all those Roman soldiers one by one? Sometimes in Peter's passion for taking the initiative, he overlooks the obvious big picture's realities of the situation. But with all his brashness, Peter had the raw material to make a leader from. And I think it's probably better to work with a man like that than it is to try to motivate somebody who's always passive and always hesitant. It's easier to tone down a fanatic than it is to resurrect a corpse. Some people have to be dragged tediously to get them to go forward in any direction, but not Peter. Peter always wanted to move ahead. Sometimes he just didn't understand how best to do that. He always wanted to know what he didn't know. He always wanted to understand things that he didn't understand. Jesus came to the disciples one night in the middle of the Sea of Galilee, walking on the water in the midst of a violent storm. And who was it out of all the disciples that jumped out of the boat? We all know who it was. The other disciples are wondering, is it a ghost? What is it? Peter says, "Lord, if it's you, bid me come to you on the water." Jesus says one word, "Come." And before anybody knew it, Peter was out of the boat walking on the water. Now that is serious involvement. When he started thinking about the danger, he began to sink. But we've got to give him credit, I think, for having the faith to leave the boat in the first place. Nobody else was leaving that boat. Similarly, even though Peter denied Christ and has a bad name for it, we need to keep in mind that he and only one other disciple, probably the Apostle John, were the only ones who followed Jesus to the high priest's house to see what would become of Jesus. We find this in John chapter 18, verse 15. And it was in the courtyard of the high priest's house that Peter was the only one who was close enough for Jesus to turn and look him in the eyes. Only one close enough to make eye contact when the rooster crowed. Luke 22, verse 61. The point is that long after the other disciples had forsaken Christ and had fled in fear for their lives, Peter was virtually alone in a position where this kind of temptation could snare him. And he would be put in a position where he was tempted to deny the Lord. Because despite his fear, despite his weakness, there was not just anything in him that would allow him to abandon the Lord completely. So he's tried to stay as close to the Lord as he could get while still keeping as safe as he could be. I've mentioned several times that Peter had an insatiable curiosity. He had a willingness to take the initiative. He had a passion to be personally involved. That was the raw material for his leadership. So then after that, Jesus poured into Peter's life the right experiences to temper him, to shape him, to fix up that raw material into an apostolic leader. You may have noticed that sometimes we have our biggest defeats right after our biggest victories. Right after Jesus commended Peter for his great confession, in Matthew 16, 16, when Peter said, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God," it was right after that that Peter suffered the harshest rebuke ever recorded of an apostle in the New Testament. One moment Christ was calling Peter blessed, promising him the keys to the kingdom, and the next minute he's calling Peter Satan, which means an adversary or an opposer. And he's saying, get behind me, Satan. In other words, get out of my way, you adversary, you opposer of what I'm doing, because you don't even understand what I'm doing. You're looking at this from a purely human standpoint. Right after Peter's identification of Jesus for all to hear, Jesus started telling the apostles what was going to happen. I've got to go down to Jerusalem. Now that you know who I am, now that Peter has spoken these words and solidified this in your thinking, that I am the Christ, the Son of the living God. Now that you know that, it's important that you also understand that I'm going to go down to Jerusalem where I'll suffer many things of the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes, and I'm going to be killed. And that's the point at which Peter rebuked him, saying, Lord, this is not going to happen to you. And he implied that it's not going to happen to you because I'm not going to let it happen. Just let them try. I'll chop their heads off. I'll control the situation. Peter's sentiment is understandable, but he didn't understand God's plan. He didn't understand Jesus' plan. Out of his love for the Lord, he became the tempter of the Lord. He tempted Jesus to evade the cross. That's the very thing the devil was trying to do when he tempted Jesus. One of the very temptations that Satan himself gave Jesus at the beginning of his ministry in the wilderness. Without realizing it, Peter was trying to dissuade Jesus from the very thing he came to earth to do. And as usual, he was speaking when he ought to have been listening and learning. Jesus said, Peter, you're an offense to me because you're not mindful of the things of God. You're looking at this from a purely carnal approach. Peter had just learned that God would reveal truth to him as he submitted his mind to the truth. Flesh and blood has not revealed this unto you, but my Father which is in heaven. But he also learned on this occasion up at Caesarea Philippi that he was vulnerable to Satan and that Satan could fill his mouth the same way the Lord could fill his mouth. On the night of Jesus' arrest, Peter learned the hard way that he was humanly weak and could not trust his own resolve. All of his boasting promises, all of his earnest resolutions didn't keep him from falling. After he declared right in front of everybody, openly and publicly, that he would never deny Christ, he denied him anyway and punctuated his denials with passionate curses. What was happening? Satan was sifting him like wheat. And Peter learned just how much chaff there still was left in him, how little substance there actually was in him. He learned how watchful, he learned how careful he must be if he was going to rely only on the Lord's strength and grow as he should. And he also learned that in spite of his spiritual weakness, the Lord still wanted to use him. The Lord didn't say, Peter, get out of here forever. If you're going to act like that, I've got no use for you. The Lord still wanted to use him. Peter learned by experience, and sometimes the experiences were bitter. Sometimes they were distressing and humiliating and painful. Other times his experiences with the Lord were encouraging and uplifting and perfectly glorious, like when he and James and John saw Jesus transfigured, whatever that means. He saw the Lord's divine brilliance on the Mount of Transfiguration. But either way, whether the experiences were good or bad, Peter made the most of these experiences. He gleaned lessons that later helped him to help the church. Peter, just by his nature, was inclined to attempt to take control of every situation. But the Lord taught him to be subject, to be in submission. In Matthew 17, the tax collectors were in town to collect the annual 2 drachma, which was a half shekel, tax from each person 20 years old and older. Now, this was not a tax to Rome. This was a tax paid for the upkeep of the temple. And so, in general, the Jews did not resent this tax as much as they resented a number of other taxes that they had from Rome. This was a tax that was prescribed way back in the Old Testament. Exodus chapter 30, verses 11 through 16. Also talked about in 2 Chronicles chapter 24, verse 9. This tax, temple tax, was equal to 2 days' wages, so it was not a small amount of in purchasing power. But those who were collecting the temple tax came to Peter and said, "Does your teacher not pay the temple tax?" And Peter said, yes, he pays his taxes. But it posed a problem in Peter's mind. So he went to Jesus to have a conversation about this. As the incarnate Son of God, was Jesus morally obligated to pay the temple tax? That was really the question. And Jesus could see the dilemma that Simon Peter was having, and so he asked him, "What do you think, Simon? From whom do the kings of the earth take taxes? From their sons or from strangers?" And Peter said, "From strangers. Kings don't tax their own children." And Peter drew the conclusion for Peter. Jesus drew the conclusion for Peter, "Then are the sons free?" In other words, Jesus had heavenly authority to opt out of the temple tax. The problem was, if he did that, he would send the wrong message as far as earthly authority is concerned. So the bottom line was, it was better to submit and pay the tax and avoid a situation which most people would not understand. That's what the Lord is saying here. So although Jesus was not technically obligated to pay the temple tax, he said, "Nevertheless, lest we offend them," not offend them emotionally, that they're not going to like us anymore, but offend them in the sense that we would cause them to stumble and become spiritually failures. "Lest we offend them in that sense, Peter, go to the sea, cast a hook, and take the fish that comes up first. Open its mouth and you'll find a piece of money. Take that and give it to the tax collectors for you and me." It's quite a story. You know, a lot of people I find that live out in this area where we live, they don't go over in town anymore the way we used to. Frequently, we used to be just over in town all the time. So I'm hoping you'll know what I'm talking about. But people, I think, you remember the Lake of the Woods in Swope Park? Okay, everybody pretty much still remembers Lake of the Woods. It has a long and interesting history, which I'll not recite completely, but I'll just say this much. Every once in a while, they drain the Lake of the Woods. And whenever they do, they find several cars in there where people have stolen a car for a joyride, and then they bury it in the lake, so the police will have a harder time tracing that car. They have found people's dead bodies in there, but when they drain it, if it dries out enough, there are always guys with metal detectors down there because it's a good place to find change. People go swimming, change falls out of their pockets. And there's a lot of change usually in the bottom or down in the mud of most lakes or ponds where that are in highly populated areas. So there's nothing unusual about that part. Fish strike at shiny things that are falling through the water. That's well known to fishermen. It's not unusual for a fish to swallow a coin at all. The miracle here is not only that it was the first fish he pulled up, but it still had the coin in its mouth. It hadn't even swallowed the coin. And this coin was a stater, which is worth a shekel or 4 drachma. It was exactly enough to pay the temple tax for 2. So that's the miraculous part, all the specificity there. The Lord taught Peter to submit willingly, even in cases where you don't necessarily have to, but if it would be better for everybody involved, just go ahead and submit willingly. To teach people to submit, you have to be an example of submission yourself. And sometimes a leader must submit, even when you could make a good argument or make a pretty good case that you don't have to submit. But even when there are good arguments against submitting, very often it's better to just go ahead and submit anyway. And years later, the Apostle Peter would write in 1 Peter 2, verses 13 through 18, "Submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake." This is the same thing he learned from the Lord when he was dealing with the taxes. "Submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether it be to the king as supreme or to governors, for this is the will of God, that by doing good you may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men." Jesus knew that if he didn't pay that tax, most people who saw that would not understand the situation. So he just paid it anyway and got rid of the problem. Anytime you can throw a little money at a problem and get rid of the problem, it's very often the thing to do. So this is the same lesson that Peter learned from Jesus, and then Peter, in turn, passed that lesson on to us, that by doing good, you may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men. In other words, don't use your freedom as a covering for evil. See yourself as the Lord's slave and operate as his slave. Now, learning to submit was not an easy lesson for a natural leader like the Apostle Peter. But Peter learned restraint. That night in the garden when Jesus said, "Peter, put up your sword." That must have been awfully hard to take in front of the hordes of enemies that were all around them. But Peter learned from what he saw that night that there's more than one way to skin a cat, and the Lord knows the best way. And later he would write that the Lord suffered for us, leaving us an example that we should follow in his steps. That's 1 Peter 2, verses 21 through 23. Talking about Jesus, who did no sin, neither was deceit found in his mouth, who, when he was reviled, reviled not in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but committed himself to him who judges righteously. There were a lot of things Jesus could have said that would have been true. There were a lot of arguments he could have put forth. He could have talked about how unfair the system was, how wrong it was, that there was so much corruption in the government, and God knows there was. The high priesthood was totally corrupt at this time. Jesus could have gone into a dissertation about that and been absolutely right, but it was beside the point. God had set this plan in motion. Jesus was submitting his will to the will of his Father, and that was the point. And Peter came to understand that, to go along with what the Lord was. You know, every chapter in 1 Peter, he talks about suffering. Because he learned to suffer with the Lord. Sometimes even when you don't have to, it's best to suffer with the Lord. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but committed himself to him who judges righteously. How different this is from the man who grabbed his sword to whack his way through all the opposers. Peter learned restraint. He learned humility. Jesus said, "All of you will be made to stumble because of me this night." That's in Matthew chapter 26, verse 31. All of you, speaking of his apostles, all of you will be made to stumble because of me this night. And you know what Peter said? Even if all of them stumble because of you, I will never be made to stumble. I will never deny you. That's in verse 33. Lord, I'm ready to go with you both to prison and to death. That's a flat statement, Luke 22, 33. But as we all know, and as I've already mentioned, Peter denied Christ multiple times, just as Jesus had warned. Peter's shame and disgrace at having dishonored Christ so flagrantly were only magnified by the fact that he had boasted so publicly and so stubbornly that he wouldn't. And now he did. But the Lord used that to make Peter humble. And when he wrote his first epistle, he said in chapter 5, verses 5 and 6, "Be clothed with humility, for God resists the proud and gives grace to the humble. Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time." In those days, roads were either muddy or dusty, depending on the amount of rainfall you'd had recently. Roads were either muddy or dusty, and so everybody's feet were constantly dirty. And when you went to a house for a meal, there was usually a servant whose job it was to wash the feet of the guest. That was considered one of the least desirable jobs. At the Last Supper in the upper room, there evidently had been no provision made for a servant to do that. So as everybody knows, Jesus got down and washed his disciples' feet. But when he got to Peter, Peter said, "Lord, you'll never wash my feet." You know, Peter is the master of the absolute statement. "I'll never deny you. You'll never wash my feet." He's just so positive about things that he doesn't really know about. So Jesus just says to him, "Well, if I don't wash you, you have no part with me." This is John 13:8. And Peter's answer is typical of his unbridled wholeheartedness. "Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head. Just give me a bath, a complete bath." There was never any middle ground with Peter. It was always all or nothing. So Jesus assured him that in spiritual terms, he was completely clean. After Judas left, Peter told the other 11, "A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another as I have loved you." And by this will all men know that you are my disciples, if you have love one for another. This is John 13, verses 34 and 35. Peter learned to love, and it became one of the hallmarks of his teaching. In 1 Peter 4, verse 8, he wrote, "Above all things, have fervent love for one another, for love will cover a multitude of sins." I've mentioned that Jesus told Peter that the devil has asked for you that he may sift you like wheat, Luke 22, 31. We might have expected Jesus to reassure Peter that he wasn't going to let the devil do that. Satan has asked for you to sift you like wheat, but I'm not going to let him do that. That seems like the normal thing, the natural thing for the Lord to say. But that's not what he said. That's not what he said, and that's not what he intended at all. Because Jesus needed to let Peter go through that, and Peter needed to go through it. Instead of saying, "I'm not going to let the devil do that to you, Peter," he said, "Peter, I'm going to let Satan toss you to the wind until there's nothing left but the reality of your faith." But he did tell him, "I have prayed for you that your faith fail not. And when you return to me, when you're converted, strengthen your brethren." That's in verse 32. Peter needed to learn compassion through his own ordeal, so that when it was over, he could strengthen others in their ordeals. And after being sifted, Peter had a strength that he'd never had before. He had an understanding of other people that he'd never had before. And Peter was well equipped to empathize with other people's weaknesses. So in 1 Peter 5, verses 8 through 10, he wrote, "Be sober, be vigilant." And he wrote this to us as the church. "Be sober, be vigilant, for your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Resist him steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same sufferings experienced by your brothers in the world are the same sufferings are also experienced by your brothers in the world. May the God of all grace, who called us to eternal glory by Jesus Christ, after you have suffered a while, perfect, establish, strengthen, and settle you." Peter had been to the bottom. He'd made an absolute fool of himself, and his own weakness had been thrown back in his face. But after that process, he had been perfected, established, strengthened, and settled. So as usual, Peter, in writing his epistles, was writing out of his own experience. And finally, Peter had to learn courage. Not the impetuous kind of courage. He already had some of that. But the intrepid willingness to stick with the Lord no matter what, through thick and thin. In John 21, 18, the Lord said to him, "Peter, when you were young, you girded yourself and you went wherever you wanted to. But when you're old, you will stretch out your hands and another will gird you and carry you where you do not wish." And John tells us that Jesus spoke this signifying by what death Peter would glorify God. That's in John 21, 19. The price of preaching the gospel of Christ would be death for Peter. When he saw the risen Christ and knew that Christ had conquered death, he knew that whatever earthly trials came his way were just going to be merely temporary. And later he wrote in 1 Peter 1 about the inheritance that's incorruptible and undefiled and that fadeth not away, reserved in heaven for you. He gradually changed from Simon into rock. He learned submission, he learned restraint, he learned humility, he learned love, he learned compassion, and he learned courage. He preached at Pentecost and 3,000 people were saved. He and John healed a lame man. People would be healed by the very shadow of Peter passing over them. He raised Dorcas from the dead. He introduced the gospel to the Gentiles. He wrote two epistles in which he featured the very same character lessons that he had learned from the Lord. Was he perfect? No. And we'll start with one of his glaring imperfections as an apostle after the church was established, when we come back later. But right now, it's time for your 10-minute break.